Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your locally owned and independent bookstores. I am pleased to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author Stephen Hunter. You know Stephen's work through his 16 previous novels and his irresistible series hero, Bob Lee Swagger, and certainly you recognize him from the Washington Post, where he was the longtime chief film critic, winning the 2003 Pulitzer Prize for Distinguished Criticism. So tonight, Stephen is here. He's returned to the Tattered Cover with Bob Lee Swagger to present his newest thriller, I, Sniper. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Stephen Hunter.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming out. Denver's always been good to me, and I love to come to the Tattered Cover for three reasons. First of all, because it's a repository, even a relic query of the bones of saints, that is, the books that great men and women have written. Secondly, because it also services another human need, which is entertainment, diversion, escape from the self. And thirdly, and possibly most importantly, because it's only 15 minutes from the nearest Hooters. And that's really important to me. I just want you to I'll tell you a little bit about how this book came to be. It was a troubled birth, but a happy childhood. I think of books as children because I've slapped them around and I've yelled at them and I've made them obey, and some refuse to obey, and some are delinquent and some are little good boys and girls, and then they go out in the world and I never have any idea what the world is going to make of them, and some of them are beloved and some of them are not beloved, and it's always a surprise to me. In this particular case, I was sitting at a table at a restaurant called Michael's, which is the New York publishing restaurant. You know, the food looks like, I don't know, crabgrass and tofu or something like that. And you can't get a burger or a Coney Island hot dog or anything decent there. And I was kind of the butt of the table because I just published a book called Night of Thunder, and it is did not done very well. I think the reason it didn't do many very well was because a lot of people thought that I was crassly ripping off NASCAR culture in order to make a cheap buck off of it. And the reason I got that impression, I think, as I think about it, was because I was cheaply ripping off NASCAR culture in order to make a buck off of it. In any event, so they were, every idea I had, they were into me for money. I'd already signed a contract, so they couldn't get rid of me without calling in, battalions of lawyers, and they didn't want to do that. So they were just sort of having fun swatting me around like a pinata. And every idea I had, they didn't like. I had an idea. I always wanted to do a big World War II novel because the novels that taught me the joy and the fabulousness of the fictional world were those books that I read in the 50s, like The Caine Mutiny and The Big War and Away All Boats. And those were just books that transfixed me. And I've always loved that war. I mean, you shouldn't love a war, but that had, it was the men who won that war for us were great men, and I wanted to celebrate them. I've done a little of that through Earl Swagger, but I just wanted to, they're all 35. They never heard of World War II. I had explained to them who won, and that was, it was downhill from them. I'm lying like a rug up here. They're very smart, decent people, and they didn't treat me badly. But I did feel that I was, this is all negotiation. It's all barter. And I did feel that they weren't ready to be impressed. And then suddenly I remembered an idea I'd had 15 years before. And it was a Bob Lee Swagger novel, and it had to do with the murder of four or five peace activists by someone who clearly had high marksmanship skills and was, in fact, may well have been a Marine sniper. And as I had imagined it back then, the motive for this killing was that the sniper, who had been revered as the leading sniper in Vietnam, had just learned he was no longer the leading sniper in Vietnam. This actually happened in sniper culture. If anyone here is conversant with that, I'll spare you the names of the actual people. So that made him vulnerable to manipulation by conspirators. And Bob was then brought in to figure out what really happened, sort of penetrate the conspiracy to see who benefited, to see who put it together and how it was put together. And that was the idea, and that was the start of the idea. That was also the end of the idea, because I couldn't figure out where to take it from then. And I tried several ridiculous avenues. Again, I won't bore you with the comical possibilities, because I want you to like me, not think I'm a fool. So I went on, and that was the book that really lit them up. They wanted another Bob book. To be honest with you, I was a little tired of Bob. If for no other reason, Bob never gets laid. He's too damn noble. And I wanted a character who had a little bit more, I won't say suppleness, but should we say flexibility? And that, no one wanted that. I keep, my agent is a wonderful woman named Esther Newberg, and every time I bring up the idea of Bob having a little adventure, she just goes ballistic. And this woman is known throughout New York for her ferocity. I mean, she eats people alive, and she got like all the way to my shoulder bone the last time. So we don't even mention that anymore. So I had to go home and figure out where to take it. And I did that the good old-fashioned way, by working hard. And I came up with an idea that I liked. And it seemed to me, because it's 400-odd pages long, you know there's a conspiracy. I mean, you're not going to read 400 pages to come to the realization that there never was a conspiracy and everybody was just making stuff up. So I came up with what I thought was a pretty good conspiracy, and I set out to write it. And I have to say, from that point on, things really went well. And it was a book, you know, I'd been hearing from so many people that they wanted another classic sniper novel. I'd written the fabulous NASCAR book, and I'd written before that a book that reflected my interest in the Japanese samurai movie. And all the Amazon reviews said, "Where are the rifles?" And no one was really interested in me on the subject of swords. I thought it was fascinating. But anyway, that book, though, surprisingly had done quite well. And that's perhaps why Simon & Schuster didn't dump me when it could have, after the fiasco of the NASCAR book. And the book, I hate to say this, I know artists and writers like to present themselves as sufferers, fighting existential angst, risking their soul against the darkness of chaos, but it was a piece of cake. I mean, the book just wrote itself, and that happens sometimes. It has not always happened. I wrote a book years ago called The Spanish Gambit, and I was so sick of it that the only way I could finish it was to get drunk every night. And when I look at it, sometimes I'll come up with passages that were clearly written by a man, you know, way beyond rationality. But somehow I got through that one. If I ever told you the true story of how these things are sometimes assembled at the kitchen table or on the kitchen floor, you'd be horrified. But this one was not like that. This was kind of an ideal writing experience, and it just went quickly, and the book kept presenting me with surprises that I hadn't anticipated on, the way things worked out. were always very surprising to me, and I think that's good. I'm an outliner. If you hear other authors, particularly other thriller writers, you'll know that we're divided into schools, outliners and anti-outliners. Michael Connelly, for example, is an anti-outliner. I am pro-outline, because the last place I want to be is facing a computer screen at 4 in the morning with no idea of what happens next and waiting for inspiration to strike. Inspiration is fine, but it's lazy. It's, you know, it's unreliable. It's like the employee that you'd really like to fire, but the union protects. You know, it's just not fun. So I always outline. And then what happens is, as I'm interacting with the outline, the characters begin to present possibilities to me. I try and fill them with an independent life. And frequently they will tell you, I know this sounds kind of new agey, but they will tell you what they want to do, and they will tell you when something isn't right, or you'll do something that you think is casual and you're not, and yet it was just such a perfect decision. A perfect example in this book, as you will discover when you read it, is it ends up in the Old West. And the reason it ends up in the Old West, the reason it, quote, travels through time, doesn't really travel through time, but it ends up in a Western gunfight scenario. That was because I had a villain whom I knew wasn't going to do much in the book except call in and get reports. And it's hard to keep people interested in a remote voice on a phone. So I thought, let's have him be obsessed with something interesting. As I'm sure many of you know, there's a burgeoning new sport called cowboy action shooting, in which people buy all the guns that were, you know, Old West style six shooters designed before 1898, and adapt personas and put on outfits and just sort of relive. Actually, they're not really reliving the Old West, as they're reliving the Westerns of the 50s. And so I thought, I'll have him devoted to this. And people do get extremely devoted to it. And that brought me to a climax that I think, at least, is just perfect for the book. And it was not something I'd planned. It just shows how, or at least it wasn't planned rationally. A lot of the work that goes into these things is subconscious. Your subconscious is always trying out possibilities, and you're not even aware of it. And when it figures something out, it knocks on the door and it tells you, and it feels like an explosion of inspiration. And only later do you realize that it's made up of things you'd thought about and discarded, and they'd sunk into yourself, into your subconscious. And I always think of it as having a Rubik's Cube inside, and it's always twisting and turning. And some of the stuff is, you know, scenes from old TV shows and movies, advertisements from the Saturday Evening Post in 1958, lines of poetry, a painting I once saw 38 years ago, and all those things, forgotten as they are completely alive in the subconscious. And again, as I say, when it finds a nice arrangement for them, when it finds a line that it considers interesting, it informs you with a thunderclap. And as I say, it feels like a thunderclap. It feels like God is speaking to you, or Mother Nature, or whatever. But it's really yourself, your subconsciousness, telling you that it's discovered something. And I, so I live, make my living off those moments. And fortunately, in this book, there were several of them. I'm very proud to announce. In fact, the first time I was ever to make this announcement, I made it at another branch of this store here in Denver, and that is that the book is debuting next week at number 14 on the New York Times bestseller list. So I'm very, thank you very much. I'm very pleased with that. I hope that you enjoy it, and I'll be very happy now to answer any questions you want. I'll even tell you my favorite young lady at the Hooters. No. Yes, sir.
As a film critic, what do you think of The Shooter?
I love the director Antoine Fuqua. He is a great action director. He made a movie called Tears of the Sun, which I think is probably his best film. Of course, he also made Training Day. That was the movie. That was his big hit movie. And I loved what he did with the action sequences, and I loved about the first half of the movie. And then I thought it got a little twisted. It went areas, it went in directions I wasn't comfortable with. The ending, which I don't believe Antoine directed, because it was, if you think about it, that shootout or that murder spree at the end of the movie, that's not Bob Lee Swagger, A. And B, it was very clumsily directed, very crudely directed, whereas Antoine had brought, he'd really thought about the way men with guns move against each other. And I think even if you know nothing about the subject, you feel that. And the whole crew trained at front sight, so they were familiar with the operation of firearms and the way men with guns related to each other in moments of stress. And I think that's why the movie, people feel that even if they don't know that. But I was very disappointed in the ending. I thought it was a big mistake. I was not consulted. I was shown the movie late, and I sent them an email, and I tried to get them to change the ending, but they wouldn't. He said he'd shown it to the foreign press, and the foreign press loved it. And I thought, duh, that's why they're the foreign press. Anyway, it was, and the movie, you know, a lot wrote on the movie, and it was kind of a disappointment financially. I know that Mark Wahlberg had hoped that it would become a series, and he said to me at one point, he said, and he's, you know, he's a tiny little guy, and he's got a high, squeaky voice when he's not acting. He said, "Golly, Mr. Hunter, I hope we get to make all your books into movies." "There, there, son, I hope you do too." And it was, you know, it was kind of a wash. I sold a lot more paperbacks. They'd paid me for it years ago. It educated my children and financed my first three divorces. No, that's, I'm joking. It did educate my children. So I can't, you know, there is something, an old value in the world that I believe in called honoring the patron. I mean, they paid me the money. I took the money. So it's not really right of me to, it would not have been right of me at the time to have made a big stink about it. And I now, when I'm asked casually, like you just have, that's as close to an honest answer as you'll get from me. Yes, sir.
I've tried writing, and I must say that I discovered how hard it is. And all of the books that I've read, you certainly take me to a place, and I get to escape money to the place that I want to go.
Mm-hmm. And thank you very much.
And I thank you.
Thank you.
Really good. You mentioned earlier that writing this book, that it seemed to come, but your work, do you have like a work habit? Do you sit down daily and write 6 to 8 hours a day?
I couldn't do 6 or 8 hours a day. I think it's really, it's an issue of concentration, and I can only stay concentrated for about an hour and a half. And I write about an hour and a half a day. And otherwise, I'm shooting or drinking or sleeping. It's basically what I do. And people are always amazed how much I get out of how little. In fact, I was at a party last year, and Jonathan Yardley, who's the book critic of the Washington Post, and he said, "Steve, I've always been curious, how long do you work on a book every day?" And I said, "Oh, Jonathan, it's usually about an hour and a half." He said, no, it can't be that. No, seriously, how much do you work?" And I said, "Well, to be honest with you, it's an hour and a half." And he said, "Oh, don't be ridiculous. What, 3 or 4 hours? I think it's 4 hours. I'm glad that you're able to." So he ended up telling me that I was wrong about my myself. And he saw nothing paradoxical about that. I mean, this is how some of these people, how seriously they take themselves. But I can only get up there. I say, I need a certain level of concentration. And one of the keys to writing, I mean, I have a little lecture I do in which I say, I can teach you how to write a novel in 6 words. I won't give you the whole lecture. I will give you the 6 words. And the 6 words are start now, meaning don't put it off, meaning start now. Nothing ambiguous about that. You can lie to yourself about research and this and that and more things to think about, but those are excuses. Start now. The second thing I say is work every day. And I mean every day. And when I'm working on a book, I try and work every day. And if I miss, it's not because of a conscious decision. It's because of a flat tire or a bad cold or, you know, a terrible hangover, or there's some outside physical reason for not doing. And most important thing, though, is the last word, which is finish. Because so many people start projects and they just they lose contact with them. I know how books die. And the way a book dies is you work every day for a week and you're feeling really proud of yourself. You're so proud of yourself, you award yourself a day off. And then the day after the day off, you really don't feel like working. And you, after all, you did work 7 straight days, so you award yourself another day off. Suddenly you've missed 4 or 5 days, so you're really angry at yourself. You force yourself to get up early the next day, and you work really hard. And you work for like 8 straight hours. And you're feeling so good about yourself that you award yourself another day off. And suddenly it's next year, and there's no book. There's 47 pages in a drawer somewhere, and they may be the best pages anyone ever wrote. Who cares? You know, you've got to finish the thing. And I always, my joke that I play on myself, I use this at writers' conferences too, is the day I start a book, 200 other people start books. Okay, and they're smarter, and they're funnier, and they're more talented than I am. And you would enjoy them so much more than you're enjoying me. But too bad for them and too bad for you, because I'm the guy that finished the book. And that's the reality. And there are lots of people who aren't very talented who have careers in publishing because they have that kind of... I mean, again, I don't want to turn this into a writing seminar, but... I don't want to say that it's willpower, because if you're consciously asserting willpower, you're exhausting yourself. And sooner or later, your willpower is going to fade. And what will happen is exactly what I just laid out. It's not willpower, it's habit. You have to make working on the book very similar to brushing your teeth. You wouldn't think of going to bed without brushing your teeth. And yet you don't lie. You know, you're not in the office worried that you're not going to brush your teeth. You know, brushing your teeth is part of your life. And you've got to make the book part of your life, or the project part of your life, so that you can get into that concentrated state quickly, do the work, and get out. And the longer you put off, see, the thing that kills books is that it takes a lot of effort to get to that concentrated state. It's like a muscle, and you want it to be supple. And when I'm at my best, I can get there really fast and get out really fast. And yet, if I start skipping and I have to make myself work, the whole project falls apart. So here's another metaphor I use, and that is, think of it as baseball, not football, meaning you play every day. It's a long season. You'll make mistakes. You'll make errors. You'll have slumps. You'll be very angry at yourself. You'll be very depressed at yourself. But over the long run of the season, if you have talent, your talent is going to eventually express itself. And that kind of attitude is how you write a book. If you think of it as football, and there's just a few intense moments, you can't... you lose too much when you fail. You can't, you know, 1/16 of the season is gone when you lose, and that may be irrecoverable. I know about football. I'm a Ravens fan. Anyway, so I didn't want to bring up any sort of subjects. Just, please don't hurt me. I didn't want to get hurt tonight. you know how it goes year by year. Football somehow, and I'm also not being fair to football, because football, I'm just talking about perceptions of football, but preparing for football is like baseball. It's every day. But at any rate, what I'm trying to make clear is you can't do it dramatically. You can't expect drama. You can't expect inspiration. You can't expect opera. You can't expect thunder and lightning. It's just got to be a dreary, do it every day kind of thing. And the less drama, the better. And surprisingly, that winnows out a lot of people. Very talented people, brilliant people can't do that, whereas some not so brilliant people can do it. And it's just, you know, there's just such a reward for finishing. I'm sorry, I talked way too long on that subject. Thank you all very much. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.